I want to say a little bit about what precipitated the lawsuit, what some of the legal and theological issues in it are, and what the likely consequences will be in terms of our church membership, win or lose. Whether we lose the suit or win the suit, I think it's a significant enterprise because of the educational value that it has for us in church-state relations in this country, if we make use of it in that kind of way, if we make use of its educational value for us. And I'm going to say a little about that. It's my opinion that in our system there will always be a degree of tension between the organized church and the organized state, that is, between government and religion as institutions. I think that tension is legitimate. I think it's inevitable. I think it's appropriate. I don't think it's something we should be ashamed of or try to smooth away. It's probably true in all systems that that ought to be the case, but I think in ours in particular, because of the First Amendment, which guarantees certain freedoms to religion that do not exist constitutionally in many other systems, and because of the ambiguity of our First Amendment. For 200 years, we've been trying in the courts to figure out exactly what it means in given circumstances, because it's so general that it needs constant interpretation. This is a First Amendment lawsuit. It is another in an endless string of legal tests of what the First Amendment means in relation to government and religion. The suit itself was filed in January of 1986, on January 13th. The suit was filed in federal district court in Phoenix, Arizona, by six plaintiffs, with the federal government as the defendant. The six plaintiffs are the American Lutheran Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, two national denominations, and four local congregations: Elzona Evangelical Lutheran Church of Phoenix, which is ALC related, Southside Presbyterian Church of Tucson, and Camelback and Sunrise Presbyterian Churches of Phoenix. The suit alleges that the federal government and its Immigration and Naturalization Service behaved improperly in conducting undercover investigations in gatherings of these four Arizona congregations during 1984. The suit seeks a court judgment, a declaratory judgment, that such behavior is unconstitutional. And we'll get into the particular behavior in a moment. That is a violation of the free exercise of religion protection of the First Amendment, and that such behavior should be forbidden in the future unless there is prior judicial review and approval. The suit seeks, therefore, a judgment that due process be followed. And the due process, which we allege should be followed, is when government believes there is criminal behavior going on in a church meeting, government should not be barred from investigating it, even with undercover methods, but should have first to go to a judicial authority, a judge, show just cause, probable cause, persuade the judge that something illegal may be going on, and get a court order, get the judge's warrant to proceed, which is exactly what we all now are protected. We have that kind of due process protection now from search and entry into our own homes. There is, under our Constitution, no permission for government to enter our homes without a warrant. It's that same kind of protection that we're seeking to establish for religious gatherings. A little bit on the background. During 1984, for about 10 months, in fact, agents hired by the federal government used undercover behavior to enter church meetings, to pose as friends of the sanctuary movement, as it happened in this case, because it was investigation of the sanctuary movement that led to this behavior. And they passed themselves off as not only friends of the sanctuary movement, but friends of the ministry of those churches to people who were undocumented, people from El Salvador for the most part, some Guatemalans. When it was revealed in January 1985, it was revealed what had happened because the government handed down indictments. which led to the well-publicized sanctuary trial in Tucson that was just completed. When it was revealed, all sorts of distress occurred in those four congregations. Let me read to you a summary of the kinds of things that happened. The ministries of these congregations, and we allege this in our complaint, have been affected in several ways. Members are now suspicious of strangers at church, believing they may be government spies. Members wonder if telephone calls seeking counsel from their pastors are tapped. Some members have left the membership, thinking their government employment security clearances are endangered because of membership in those congregations. A Bible study weekly outreach program in the Hispanic community surrounding Elzona Lutheran Church has discontinued. Nobody comes anymore. In summary, a climate of mistrust and fear has followed the revelation that persons posing as friends of the churches and their ministries with refugees were in fact paid government agents. The sense of trust and community on which free religious exercise, free religious association is based, has been seriously undermined. Well, that's what the complaint alleges. What is the present situation? The complaint was filed in January, and a judge was selected at that time by a lottery system, which is what is used in the Arizona federal courts. The lawyers who filed the suit for us reached in and pulled a number out of a hat, and that indicated which judge we got. So we know who the judge is. The government responded then and said, let's wait until the Tucson trial is over before we proceed, and we agreed to that, because many of the witnesses and much of the documentation in the Tucson trial, which is about sanctuary, are also involved in our suit, which is not about sanctuary, but is based in the same soil. The investigation of sanctuary is what led to our complaint. Now that the verdict was reached in the Tucson trial, I think April 30th, the government around the end of May filed a motion, or a series of motions actually, asking for a dismissal of the suit, which is their right. They are making two basic points. First, they are saying there is no proof of damage to the religious bodies, the six bodies that filed the complaint. And basically they're saying we can't prove monetary loss. And our basic contention is not a monetary damage, but a damage to the fabric of community, of trust in religious gatherings. So it'll be interesting legally to see if that will be upheld, first by the judge who has to answer the government's motions, and then by a jury if it gets to a jury. The second point that the government is making is that only individuals can claim religious liberties were violated, not bodies, not groups, not organizations, not communities of believers. They are also saying that the national churches have no interest in this because if there was damage done, it was done only to the local churches, and our response to that is a theological one based on St. Paul, when one part of the body suffers, the whole body suffers. And we're saying that we are inextricably tied together in a fellowship of congregations nationwide. The church's attorneys, our attorneys, are now preparing a response to the government's motions for dismissal. And we will, of course, try to answer their argument and say, no, this should not be dismissed. This should come to trial. Then the judge will have to issue an opinion. And if we are upheld in our argument that this ought to come to trial, ought to be tested in the courts, then it will proceed to trial. We are fairly confident that we will be upheld because it seems to all of us, the lawyers involved and people who know the history of church-state relations in this country, that this issue has never been tested in the courts and ought to be. However it comes out, it ought to be tested. There ought to be a judgment rendered. If it does go to trial, there will be a jury. The judge will first issue an opinion saying whether or not it should proceed. If he says yes, it will should proceed, then there will be a jury trial. Once a verdict is reached in that trial, then the loser will undoubtedly appeal it. That's what happens typically with groundbreaking test cases, which this is. There's very little precedent. And so it'll go then to the appellate court, which sits in San Francisco, the appellate court for that region. Then, most likely, whoever loses at the appellate court level will appeal it to the Supreme Court of the United States. So the attorneys think it could very well go to the Supreme Court and therefore might take as long as 3 or 4 years to be litigated. So we're in for something for the long haul here, but we're into something that all of the people involved, particularly the legal advisors, feel is a very important issue to be tested. In fact, the law firm in Phoenix, Lewis and Rocha, which is handling the case for us, is doing it pro bono. That means for the common good, without fee. Now, they are quick to say they are not doing it just out of the goodness of their heart. They are doing it because they think it's an important issue, but also because they know that when a law firm is identified and lawyers are identified with a landmark case of this kind, there is value in that for them. And they're very openly saying that. Lawyers like to be involved with breaking through with new law, establishing a new point of law. Incidentally, the same law firm was the law firm that carried the Miranda decision through successfully some years ago through the Supreme Court, which has to do with the rights of the accused when police apprehend people. So it's a nationally recognized law firm. The lead attorney in the case is a member of one of the Presbyterian churches in Phoenix. And so he has a family interest. He has a church membership interest in the case as well. The basic legal question is, does government need to go through prior judicial review when planning surreptitious investigation in religious meetings? Our contention is yes. Government needs to do that. The government's case response to our complaint is no, government does not need to do that. Well, that's what the courts will be asked to rule on. Let me say a final point about the significance of the case and then open it up to general discussion. There's a lot more that can be said, but I think it'd be better to respond to your questions and comments and hope it comes out in that process. The significance of the case. The legal issue has not been tested in the United States history previously. We believe, we've got pretty good evidence, that there has been government infiltration of church meetings in the past, probably as long ago as the Civil War and the pre-Civil War days with the Fugitive Slave Act. We know that during the Vietnam years, there was undercover government infiltration of church meetings, both in terms of war protests that was being talked about in churches and in terms of the harboring of some military deserters, which some churches did. But nobody before has brought the government to court, has brought suit about it. A second point on that is that we are, yes, suing an executive branch of the government, but we are also using the government to seek relief. And I think that's very important. When people say, here again, the church is picking on the government, there's a sense in which that's true, but there's also a sense in which the church is using the legitimate processes of government that are afforded to all of us in our society, churches, individuals, other organizations. We are using government to seek relief from government behavior. In terms of constituency learning, I think we have an opportunity to do a great deal of education with ourselves in the churches on because of this case, if we will take advantage of that opportunity, about the importance of precision in church-state relations in our country, about the importance of the protection that we have under the Constitution's First Amendment. That's a precious protection. We ought not take it for granted. And about the importance of vigilance in protecting churches from inappropriate government behavior. We tend to think that in our country, that's not too serious a threat. I'm sure in some other countries, people thought that too, initially, and did not nip in the bud the first government intrusion that may have been inappropriate. Finally, for the American Lutheran Church and for Lutherans in general, there is some particular irony in all of this. There's a sense in which the church is suing its own people. Two of the principal officers of the government who are in fact being sued in this case, the Attorney General of the United States, Edwin Meese, because the Immigration and Naturalization Service is in the Department of Justice, and the head of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, Alan Nelson, are both members of the same congregation of the ALC in Washington, D.C., in suburban D.C. That's an irony, but I think it's also a reminder to us again of how in our society, very often, the church as a body includes people on both sides of an issue. And in this case, the church has two, I have every reason to believe, faithful members who are faithful civil servants seeking to do their job in government as they see it or as they are by their superiors asked to do it. I know that's true with Mr. Nelson. I've not met with Mr. Meese, but Bishop Preuss and several of us met with Mr. Nelson a year ago, July, about this infiltration matter, before we filed suit, before we'd even thought of going to court with it. We talked with him for about an hour and a half. And the most heated discussion was around the issue of infiltration of churches to gather evidence. And we asked him pointedly, is this the kind of behavior that immigration and naturalization will continue to do? Or will you assure us that this was a one-time excess and you won't repeat it? He said, we don't like to do it, but I can't assure you that we won't do it again if the need arises. We pressed him, we leaned on him pretty hard and said we were quite offended by this and we thought it was an intrusion that was unnecessary. We knew that the people in Phoenix had said very openly that any information the government wanted about what they were doing with sanctuary, with ministry with refugees, they would willingly have given very openly. And in fact, most of it had already been published in newspapers. There was nothing undercover about their behavior. And so we didn't think this kind of activity was necessary. But Mr. Nelson held firm and said no, he couldn't assure us that they wouldn't do it in the future. We had the impression in talking with him that and his pastor came with him, by the way, Ben Bartel, who was in seminary with me. Ben came along and listened through all of this discussion and later told us, and we had evidence of that from the conversation itself, that Mr. Nelson is a faithful church member. He's not just a nominal name on the rolls. And he wants to be a faithful church member. He also wants to be a faithful civil servant. So there's the tension again within one person. In this case, he thinks his church is wrong now in bringing suit. He's told us that. So I expect that as the case develops, there will be press attention to the fact that here one of the churches is suing, in effect, the agency headed by one of its own members. That's all right. I think in our system that's proper, that's legitimate. When that happens, we have an understanding that people have vocational calls under God to do what they think is right. And I think the leaders of the church are doing what they think is proper, and Mr. Nelson is doing what he thinks is proper. One more point. The ALC got into the suit in the first place because our congregation in Phoenix asked us to. Little congregation. It was once self-supporting, Anglo-white, Northern European background, about 600 members. It has now declined because of a changing neighborhood to less than 150 members. Its neighborhood is now largely Hispanic. 5 or 6 years ago, they called a Spanish-speaking pastor, Jim Oines, graduate of Luther Northwestern Seminary, a Norwegian kid from the Dakotas. But Jim has Spanish, and they wanted to address their community. And Jim had begun to do that. As part of that work, that congregation had been led into work with undocumented persons. They have been harboring some of them on church property. They have some space in the building where they have families staying temporarily while they're en route to somewhere else. They had also begun this Sunday evening Bible study that was all in Spanish and was an attempt to reach non-members in the community. It was drawing 30 to 40 people. What were they doing there? Well, Jim says, and the record indicates that this is true. They were studying the book of Exodus. They were talking about the relationship between the book of Exodus and the people of Israel leaving Egypt and the people of Central America leaving their home and fleeing for their safety. They were making those connections. Is that political talk? I suppose it is. I think it has political implications by all means. The government's contention is that these were not church meetings, these were not Bible studies, really, these were not spiritual, they were political. The response of that congregation is you can't separate that neatly, politics from the life of the Spirit, that they were intermixed. But that may well be one of the issues in the trial. if the court has to decide what is, quote, religious and what is not.
And who decides it? The government has to decide what is religion and spiritual or not.
Well, at least the courts. Some of us still have faith in the courts, and we know we've got good lawyers that will help us with that, and we know we have good theologians involved in trying to make the case to help the lawyers. But we'll have to see. I think it depends on what kind of a jury we get and how the judge views all of this. But yes, we are turning to the courts for relief, so that means ultimately the courts will have to decide what qualifies as religious, I think, and what qualifies as protection, what is protected under the Constitution. Some of the, in Elzona Church, the Lutheran parish, it was primarily the Bible study that an agent named Jesus Cruz, which is an interesting name if you're looking for ironies in this case. His name is Jesus the Cross, right? Jesus Cruz is Jesus the Cross. Himself a Hispanic, a Mexican-American, who had been making his living before the government hired him as a coyote. A coyote is one in that region, that's the name given to one who, for pay, smuggles people across the border, usually to work in the fields. But the government people knew him, and he'd been in trouble with government himself, and so they turned to him and said, will you work for us? And there was another one who was working in the Presbyterian churches. It wasn't just the Bible study that was infiltrated, it was church worship services and other kinds of meetings in churches. I think I'll just stop there and invite your questions or comments. Cliff. They don't, either if they go into a street demonstration, a political gathering in a public park or anything of that sort, we're arguing that, and our attorneys think we have good basis for it, that religion has special protection under the Constitution, which other such things do not. Just as our homes do, it's spelled out, I think, in the Fourth Amendment against unlawful search and seizure. We're trying to contend that under the First Amendment, religious gatherings have a kind of protection that other gatherings do not have, and other associations do not have. Because I think if it could be demonstrated by the government that it were, whatever that means, purely political, not religious at all, it would not have protection. It would not have the protection of the First Amendment, which guarantees the right to free association in religious association. And of course, we're trying to use a definition of religion that is broad enough to include the discussion of politics that comes out of the study of the book of Exodus, or the discussion of political behavior that comes out of trying to minister to people who are in the country illegally. So inevitably, the case is going to be all tied up with the sanctuary question. We know that. And yet we're trying to say in our complaint and with our constituency that it is not essentially about sanctuary. That's a separate issue. This is about what kind of protection does religious association have under the Constitution from surreptitious entry by government agents. Could have been to investigate the making of a nuclear device in a church basement, or it could have been about tax evasion or something like that. And we probably would all welcome that our FBI agents, Federal Bureau of Investigation agents, and whoever they employ, deputize, should be investigating all sorts of things like that for the protection of us all. I think the issue here is a very narrow one. Are there any limits on how government behaves in regard to such investigations in churches? And must it follow some kind of due process? I don't think it would be bad at all. I think it would be an additional safeguard that you'd have to go. See, I think sometimes investigative agents get very impassioned about what they're doing, and to have a judicial review that's somewhat detached from that and a little more neutral, I think, would be a good protection.
One of the problems is, I'm sorry,
go ahead.
Confidentiality is the more people you tell about your undercover operations, the better the chance that somebody's going to find out about it.
Yeah.
It could put agents' lives at risk in mafia or drug or any kind of investigative operations. So that's one of the problems.
Yes. Oh, I don't know if the meetings would have had the same character if they'd known there were government agents there. I don't know. I don't know that. I think it would have put a damper on, as it has, the revelation that they were there has put a damper on such activities now. The Hispanic people who aren't members of Elzona Church don't come anymore to the Bible study once it was revealed that there was a government spy there. This guy, Jesus Cruz, we know quite a bit about him. He came in and said, I'm a friend of the sanctuary movement. He presented himself that way. That's how he got in. Jim Oinous and others in that church believed him. They, as they look back on it now, they think he went out of his way to offer to do things that were, was a little strange, but they naively assumed he was what he claimed to be. They took him at face value. He transported people. He did various kinds of errands. He was always around, always available. He called himself a volunteer in the sanctuary movement. They weren't quite sure what that meant. They hadn't heard of that before, but they took him at face value. And now they say they were gullible, but at the time, it all made sense. And so he was posing as something other than what he was. And that's, I think, the greatest offense to the congregation is that they feel they were violated. They were violated by this person. And they feel that that ought not be allowed to happen unless there is some kind of prior judicial review and some warrant issued. The other thing is, strangely, the government did not use any of the evidence gathered by these undercover agents in the Tucson trial. It didn't introduce any of that in evidence. And the defense in that case thinks it's because it was such unsavory behavior that it might not have persuaded a jury. It may have been counterproductive for the government's case. So the government didn't use it. Therefore, there's no established, legally established basis for claiming that criminal activity was going on through what they discovered, because none of it has been introduced in a court of law. The government won that case anyway, without that evidence gathering, which we think supports our argument that it wasn't necessary. The government won the case purely on what was publicly known. Others, yes?
Question. Let's make the assumption that there was a judicial review of this action. Would the members have felt less upset upon their discovery that there was a secret agent?
I don't know. That's hypothetical. They might have felt just as upset. But at least in that case, there would be the additional protection that a judge would have been able to say, I don't think you've proved that you have probable cause. A judge might have said, no, you can't have a warrant in this case. The judge in the Tucson trial, Judge Carroll, in the pretrial hearings where they did talk about the undercover activity, he labeled that behavior outrageous. He said that's outrageous behavior by the government, but it's not unacceptable, which is interesting. He said it was outrageous, but not unacceptable. In other words, he would allow it to be introduced in the court if the prosecutors wanted to use it. As it turned out, they didn't use it. But he called it outrageous behavior. I don't know what a judge would have done in this case. But I think all we're trying to establish is to put another line of defense there against unnecessary and irregular and sort of running roughshod with undercover agents into government, into church meetings. I suppose in some cases it won't make any difference if the judge still says, you can go ahead and investigate there with surreptitious behavior.
Could entrapment enter into that when you send somebody in and be offered to do all these things?
That's a possibility. The attorneys think that might be one additional argument, that some of the behavior of Mr. Cruz was bordering on entrapment. But that's not the heart of our case. Yes?
Is there a reason why there's only the two national church bodies that are involved in this?
Yeah.
Are there others that want to join in?
Yeah, a very good question. He said, is there a reason why there are only two national bodies, and are there others who wanted to join in? There are a lot of other religious organizations, Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish, that have expressed interest in the case, and some of whom have filed already as friends of the court, basically saying the same thing as our complaint says, but siding with it. The reason the lawyers felt it would be strongest if we went only with the two national bodies is that they are the two that have local churches that were infiltrated. There were not Methodist and Congregational and other denominations, local churches infiltrated. So it's the two parent bodies of the four local churches. But in terms of friend of the court briefs, we have a lot of other supportive bodies.
How do you really know how many churches are infiltrated? I mean, this is a secret operation.
Yeah, these are the four that have come to light. These are the four that we have, we even have the transcripts of what was recorded. The two men used body bugs. It later came out that they recorded license numbers in parking lots of cars that were there. One theory about it all is that the government's activity in this area is to intimidate. The only purpose is to intimidate, not to gather evidence, because they didn't use it, but just to intimidate, to get people in local churches fearful. And if that's their purpose, I would say to a degree they've succeeded. Elzona Church has lost members because of fear of government security clearance being in jeopardy. Some people have left, told the pastor they thought maybe their social security checks wouldn't come anymore if they belonged to that church. Well, that's ridiculous, but people have those fears. And so some intimidation has already occurred. I don't know if that was the government's objective, but I think that's one result.
Chuck.
Yes?
The function of similar spying in the civil rights and anti-war movement also was to refocus the movement's energies on litigation and court activity and away from the original purpose of their activity.
Yeah, right, right.
That's probably happening too.
Yeah. I think so. Although, I think the outcome of the Tucson trial thus far is not at all to diminish the activity of the sanctuary movement. It seems to be feeding it, if anything. And in the case of our case, it will consume the energies of a number of people for a number of years. But I don't think it'll consume a great deal of energy beyond that small group of attorneys who are working it for us. But I think you're right. In the civil rights and anti-war activity of churches, nothing ever came to trial out of that. But that may have been one objective, to sidetrack the movements. Any others? Yeah.
How much confidence do you have that the judges will say, no, you can't go into that church, or that even that, I'm not even sure if the FBI would actually consult a judge. You know, I think they're going to take sort of the Bureau of Abuse, even the existing regulations.
Well, I don't know. I guess you have to, if you're bothering with it at all, you have to have some faith that the court system will remain somewhat. I mean, I know judges understand politics and respond to public opinion. That's I think clear. But I think you have to have some faith that the judicial system in our separation of powers will remain somewhat separate from the will of a particular executive branch at a given time or a particular congressional will. That there is an independent judiciary still. And I believe that's so.
But there are lots of proof of that.
I think we do have an independent judiciary, and I think that's what we're hoping for in this case. The other thing is, we're talking only about surreptitious activity. There's no attempt to deny government the right to go and talk to people, FBI agents, to go and talk to anybody above board and say, I want to ask you some questions about this. That's not involved. I think some of us in this room have been visited on occasion by FBI people asking about an individual or asking about some group activity. We're not protesting that at all. We're protesting the posing by government agents as something other than what they are in order to gather information. And then when it becomes known what they've done, that tears the fabric of trust in a congregation. But yeah, I think basically we're hoping that the judiciary will remain independent. The recent discussion about Supreme Court appointments, history indicates that very often a president has appointed somebody to the Supreme Court expecting that person to behave in a way that's predictable according to the president's wishes. And more often than not, they don't. And so I think judges in our system are basically independent, and I hope they remain so. Yeah, I'd rather keep it focused on the issue in this case, which I think is an issue of importance to conservative and liberal believers alike, politically. conservative and politically liberal believers alike, and to non-believers, for that matter. I think it's an important issue for all in our society. And I also think that governments of both Democratic and Republican administration have behaved in this way. I don't think it's just an attack on a particular administration. I think it happens to be in this administration that the case surfaced and we think we have a good case and there was a willingness to go to court. But I think it could have been done under Kennedy or Johnson administration, too. So I don't think this case should be tied to one administration and to one presidency. So I'm trying to dodge the question of whether you can be a Republican in this moment and a Christian. That's another discussion. But I think, what will we learn from it? What will the churches do from it? I hope it will help to sensitize church people, as well as church leadership in this country, to the need for continuing vigilance about what is proper relationship between government and church. We have, I think, carved out in our history and in our constitutional protections a very special thing in this country, and I think we have to safeguard it. Some have said we ought not be in this lawsuit because of the separation of church and state, which to me is precisely the opposite argument that should be made. We ought to be in this lawsuit because of the separation of church and state, institutional separation. At the same time that we say always, that doesn't mean that faith is separated from public life. That's not the separation we're talking about. Faith is not separated from politics. But institutions of religion and government need to maintain some distance and respect each other in their proper roles. And I think we also have to say to our people, with our people, that in Lutheran understanding, God is at work through both. God is not limited to working through the church. God is also at work through government, and through bringing order and justice and welfare to people through government. So it's not as though God is on one side and the forces of evil on the other, I think. There's an opportunity here to do a lot of education in ethics and theology and in American jurisprudence and American constitutional principles, if we will do it. Now, the fact is that some of our members, there has not been as much negative reaction to the lawsuit as some of us feared. We tried to prepare the way by David Preuss sent a letter out to all of our pastors before the suit was filed, and I think that helped to communicate with our people what it was about. But there has been some negative reaction, and most often it takes this form. I believe in my government, and if my government was doing something there must have been something wrong going on. In other words, the basic negative response has been from people who said, when in doubt, I trust my government more than I trust my church or my national church leaders. That's basically what they were saying. But I hasten to add, there haven't been many of those. And there have been a lot of phone calls and letters commending the ALC for getting into this. Some people have raised the issue about legal costs, because people know that legal costs can mount tremendously in a case that goes for several years and goes to the Supreme Court. Well, they're satisfied when we tell them the lawyers are contributing their time. But the basic response from constituency has been quite heartening, I think, thus far. And I think now when it hits the press again and the trial opens or the court or the judge makes a ruling about whether it should proceed, then there'll be a new wave of constituency questions about it. And we're prepared to deal with that and use it for educational purposes. Yeah.
In your conversations, was there a statement of rationale from the informalists before the litigation and all that? So was there a statement of rationale of the government's position for the act?
Mr. Nelson said these were not religious gatherings in the traditional sense. These were not prayer and worship occasions. These were political meetings. And we challenged that. We knew something about what had happened in the Bible study. And Jim Oinous was not with us, but we had talked with him. And one of our people, Phil Anderson, who is a former missionary in Latin America and is now in El Salvador for Lutheran World Federation, Phil was with us. And Phil tried to do some theological education of Mr. Nelson by pointing out to him that sometimes the Bible leads you into discussions that are political, that there's political content or implications of biblical material. I'm not sure that that worked. I'm not sure Mr. Nelson changed his mind. But his point was these were not religious gatherings as normally understood. These were political gatherings. But, so that was the rationale.
But the worship.
But they did. They also went into church worship gatherings. That's right. And I don't know why, because they were open to the public anyway. I mean, they didn't have to do that surreptitiously. But that, I don't think they found anything that was usable for the case there either. Cliff.
Our Lord has told us in the midst of wolves that we ought to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. It seems to me one lesson in this for us is that we can be imperfect, and we ought not to be naive. So we can be infiltrated by the government, we can be infiltrated by others who want to use the church for other or subvert the church for other purposes. And we ought to be a little more, a little bit less naive and trusting than we are.
Back here.
But I feel that when you rejected what Carlos had to say, you put aside a large part of what you mean here, because the reason this suit is in the court is because the current administration has changed the interpretation of the United Nations Protocol, which defines the political refugee, and has also changed the interpretation of the United States Refugee Act. And that's why the INS is acting in this way, and that's why this all happened.
Yeah, I don't want to stop us from talking about that. That was the central issue in the sanctuary trial, which couldn't be heard because the judge ruled it out of order. I just didn't want to talk about whether you could be a Republican and a Christian. I mean, we can talk with Carlos about that if you want after this session is over. But you're right. On the sanctuary trial in Tucson, the defense wanted to introduce the discussion of who was in violation of the law, who was failing to uphold the U.S. law, which says a refugee is one who flees with a well-founded fear of persecution. And the churches there said they were giving haven to those people who qualify as refugees, and our government has refused to recognize them as refugees.
This is in keeping with what a lot of our international friends told us the other night, that many church members are extremely politically naive and extremely uninformed about what's going on.
Right.
And therefore, these things happen in their pockets.
But see, our case will not deal with that issue. I agree with, I think, what you're saying about that issue. I'm with you. But our case is not about who is a refugee. It's about what is proper government behavior in investigating anything in churches. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that we can address his question in a little narrower sense. He said that the need to politicize, to use the events for the advantage of the church. And I think by your filing lawsuit, you're doing that. I think that you need to do it more vocally, though. Yeah. My opinion, I deal with government bureaucracy, and specifically the IRS, regularly. And my impression is that these kinds of acts do not happen at the higher level. At the higher level, what they want to do is be very clean to their peers. These kinds of things where they're going to send in an undercover agent or they're going to do a despicable act, typically, though not always, happen at some low level. And by publicizing this, one thing a bureaucrat never wants to do is never wants to sit in the witness stand and have to defend his actions. And what you're doing is whether you win or whether you lose, you're saying to them, if you do things that we think are despicable, we're going to call attention in the country.
Take you to court, yeah.
And then you're going to have to, you're going to look silly, whether you win or not. People who are doing the sanctuary, when you listen to the news and read the newspapers, the government sounded silly. They may have won the case, but like you said, I believe that they galvanized a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, we really feel that even should the churches lose in this case, it may put a brake on government behavior in the future, because government agents, bureaucrats, heads of agencies will know that they might be taken to court again. So, yeah, I think that's another reason why it's worth doing, even should we wind up, in the end, losing the case.
However, if they win the case, you haven't much to take on the court on in some way.
The next time.
If they win the court.
Yeah, depends on how narrow or how broad the judgment is. Any others? I thought I saw another hand up back here somewhere, or up above. Well, I think so. The reason we met was not essentially to talk about this, what wound up being a court test. We met because he asked for the meeting with Bishop Preuss. Because at the time of the indictments in January of 85, Bishop Preuss and the other Lutheran national bishops of the Uniting Churches, I think those three, Hertzfeld, Crumley, and Preuss, issued a statement saying that they were concerned about the government's investigative techniques in this case. And that was publicized, and Alan Nelson wrote to him and said, I'd like to have a meeting with you. You're my bishop. I think you're misguided on this. I want to correct you. I want to explain to you. Clear it up. So we arranged the meeting, and we talked about a whole set of issues, including the sanctuary movement itself and whether the ALC had endorsed it, which we have not. The National Church has not endorsed sanctuary as the way to minister to refugees. It has said that congregations that elect to do it will be supported by the National Church body, but the National Church body hasn't said that's the way to go. So we tried to clarify that for Mr. Nelson. Then we got into the discussion of infiltration, and he said, I wish you wouldn't use that word. And Bishop Preuss said, what word should we use? And he said, use of undercover agents. That was acceptable. Infiltration was not. I don't know why, but that was his preference. And then we talked about whether you'll do this anymore. And he said, I won't promise you that we won't. There could be agents at Holden Village. That's true. Thank you all very much.